The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Alexis Petridis. This is Music Weekly. In this week's programme,
I discovered I didn't like being the subject of so much attention. That felt wrong. It felt uncomfortable. It felt unhealthy. It felt ill-deserved. I became completely loopy.
Scritti Politti's Green Guard Side looks back over his music career. And we review tracks by Licky Lee, Solar Bears and The Gentle Good. That's all coming up in Music Weekly from The Guardian. So, welcome to the programme. This week, Rosie Swash is trapped at her desk by a mountain of paperwork. And so we're joined in the studio for the first time by Guardian writer Pete Perfidis. Hello, Pete.
Hello. How are you?
What are you laughing for? Just put a funny voice on when you...
That's my normal voice.
Jude Rogers making a return visit to the podcast.
Hello.
How are you? Was that... No, that wasn't a funny voice. Was
no,
it?
That
you're
was
Welsh.
Just my voice. Yeah.
Alan Partridge kind of moment there on my behalf. Well, hello to both of you. We'll hear more from both of you later when we review a few tracks. But we start this week with an extended interview with Green Gartside of Scritti Politti. Green's career began in 1978, as you may know, with the release of Scritti's first single, Skank Block Bologna. There's been a few breaks in between, which he talks about in the interview, but he's continued making music up till today. Green's career began in 1978 with the release of Scritti Politti's first single, Skank Block Bologna. And although there have been a fair few breaks in between, which he talks about in the interview, he's continued making music up until today. Through six albums, the music is taken in many styles, including reggae, pop, hip-hop, and absolute the best of has just been released. So when he came in to talk, I began by asking him what it had been like for him going back over his career. The first question I wanted to ask you is how you feel when you're confronted with a greatest hits album.
Well, I was keen for it not to be called a greatest hits. I don't know, I hate greatest hits records. I haven't listened to it in its entirety. I had to attend the mastering sessions, which is a painful business, and, you know, you kind of hear a few bars of a song just to make sure it's the right song and that they're not screwing the EQ up too badly on it, and then I'd go and wait in the corridor at
Abbey
Road until the next track... Yeah.
You're just horrified by being confronted by your past?
Yeah. The past is always painful because... If there was good stuff, then it's sad that it's gone. And if there was bad stuff, it was bad stuff. So I've pursued a policy of active forgetfulness most of my life.
When I read about your sort of childhood or whatever, you always seem to get a lot of stuff about your membership of the Young Communists and that kind of thing. Less about music. What was it? What sort of music drew you into wanting to form a band rather than just handing out pamphlets or whatever?
Well, I was always an avid consumer of pop music from an early age. It started predictably with the Beatles. And so although the Beatles were not men of ideas, they were men of questions for me. So that got me thinking and got me... I like the fact that they're, you know, I wondered, taking things very literally as a boy, why, you know, this single didn't sound like the last one. You know, why didn't Paperback Writer sound like whatever the one before was? And then it was finally seeing the Clash that, you know, gave me license to form a band rather than just sit at home and listen to records.
But you didn't want to make punk, fairly obviously.
Well, by a year later, punk was kind of played, definitely, as far as I was concerned. And we were already in whatever post-punk was and drawing influences from wherever they came, you know, notably reggae.
I mean, when you decided to abandon being an indie band, you sort of write a kind of manifesto about it, about what you're going to do. Was it purely the music that interested you, or were you interested in the idea of pop stardom in and of itself?
I wasn't interested in the idea of pop stardom. I was interested in the idea of pop music. I was reading a lot of theory at the time, which had come out of, you know, didactic stuff at art school and the political history. And so, I was reading a lot of theory, and it all seemed to point in the direction of really a kind of an anti-intellectualism. You know, you could trace it back to 19th century philosophy, lazy thinking about music. And that really annoyed me. Plus, you know, indie was becoming indie with a big I, you know, and it had its, you know, suddenly there was Echo and the Bunnymen, and lots of people that wanted to be Echo and the Bunnymen, and there was a style, there was a look.
That's really interesting, there's that sort of codification of it already. You know, I mean, you're talking about in like 1980 or 81, which is always held up as this kind of, well, that's when it was really happening and da-da-da, that's when it was good, and at every point since, it's always been, indie music has always been held up against that era and found wanting. You're saying it was wanting at the time.
I thought so. Mm. There were a whole bunch of us that thought this is becoming, you know, this isn't what we were interested in. And it did reify then. There was, you know, accepted ways of doing things and a certain aesthetic style quickly had dominance. And that was really annoying.
But the reaction more widely to Songs to Remember and then to the subsequent album seems to be one of general delight. It doesn't seem to be like, well, you know, this doesn't sound like Skagg Bop Bologna. What have you done here? You know,
I don't know really. I don't remember. I think it had its detractors. I think there might have been a few people at Rough Trade that were, but they, you know, they would never confront me. I mean, you just had a suspicion. Maybe it was pure paranoia that a few people there thought it was all a bit whimsical and fey. I mean, I was all for fey and whimsy at the time. And I still have a soft spot for it in moderation. No, I don't recall it being particularly celebrated. I think the song we did, The Sweetest Girl, that was popular. Mm-hmm. I always think that Robert Wyatt's playing on it had a lot to do with that. But that was the first attempt to write a kind of pop song, and that came straight out of Lovers Rock. It was an attempt to draw on the, you know, influence of that, that I wrote The Sweetest Girl, and that worked out well for me. Mm-hmm. Although the original plan was to get, I don't know why I even thought this would work, was to get Gregory Isaacs to sing it and Kraftwerk to play it.
That's fantastic. That's a brilliant, brilliant idea.
Well, I did do a demo of it, and I took it to Jeff Travis and said, look, I've written this song. It's not at all the kind of thing that we could do, because it was a kind of pop song. And I was still at the point thinking, well, we couldn't really do this. Jeff says that he did get a response, I think, from Gregory's management saying he would be interested, but we didn't ever get a response from Kraftwerk, though I did meet Ralph and Florian a few years later, and I asked them about this, and they, I think they denied ever hearing about it, but said they wouldn't have liked to have done it because they didn't like reggae.
So you had this sort of idea of what you wanted to do all worked out. When you go on to sign to Virgin and start making really big pop records, what effect did you want those records to have? Famously, they've got a lot of complex ideas in them as well as being radio hits. Did you want? Was there part of you that sort of wanted to kind of turn the kids on to semiotics and critical theory? Or did you just...
It sounds so ridiculous now, doesn't it? It's hard to imagine that I ever seriously wanted to do that. I think I was keen to embrace the banality of pop lyricism, and that sits a bit uncomfortably with me now, I must admit. In that little bits of listening to this compilation that I did have to do, I was struck by, I think there are lots of girls and babies and stuff in it, which did make me shudder slightly. And when you kind of, you know, ran out of space to you thought, well, hang on, if I sing another girl or a baby there, that's going to be really dull. And so I'll drop in a bit of cant. And that, you know, that tickled me, really. Mm. I thought that was funny. Maybe that it came to you, but I do things that you want me to. The second time, maybe that it came to you, but all you found, my love for you. The third time, maybe that it came to you. Oh.
It's a very odd, unique kind of success you achieve in the 80s, because lots of British artists break America, and lots of kind of brainy British artists break America, clever British artists break America. But you end up hanging out with Miles Davis and stuff, which seems just a bit, you know, with the benefit of hindsight. Well, not a step too far, but with the benefit of hindsight, you just think, wow, that's kind of proper.
I don't remember being particularly overwhelmed or anything.
Really?
Or, well, yeah, although by the time of meeting Miles, I was kind of losing the plot a bit myself. I was pretty unhappy about the success that the, you know, Cupid and Psyche had brought me.
Why? Why did it sit ill with you?
Well, I didn't like being... I discovered I didn't like being the subject of so much attention. That felt wrong. It felt uncomfortable. It felt unhealthy. It felt ill-deserved. And I didn't like how moronic a lot of the, you know, the stuff that you had to do to promote that record, particularly in light of the fact that we didn't play it live. We couldn't play it live. There was an awful lot of crappy TV shows to do in America and Europe and Japan. Mm-hmm. Months and months and months of it. And that's very soul-destroying and will rot your brain. I mean, I wasn't completely mad. I became completely loopy.
Really?
At the end of a provision. Yeah, I did end up in hospital. But, however many months before that, when I met Miles and talked to him on the phone, I was just about holding it together, mm-hmm. as was he, just about holding it together, I think. God, I'd love to have a recording of some of those phone calls now.
You know, you meet a lot of pop stars who pop stardom doesn't sit very well with them. And I always think, well, if you don't like it, fuck off and do something else. And you did, which I sort of think, brilliant.
Yeah, I got back to London from spending a long time in America making the album Provision, which was a pretty uncomfortable experience, or a lot of it was. And I just decided that was it and I'd had enough. So I severed all, you know, ties with management, with the record company, with musicians, with my girlfriend, with everyone I knew in London, and went to Wales and lived a pretty solitary life for a whole heap of years. I would bang, play hip-hop pretty much all day, every day in the cottage in Wales, and then walk through the lanes and fields and then get to the pub in the evening to play darts, and I did that every day for years.
Sounds quite nice.
Yeah,
quite a pleasant existence. You
know, it was. I think I was probably clinically depressed through it all. But
Yeah, obviously there's that side of it as well. I don't mean to make light of your.
That doesn't. You know, I was able to. You know, yeah, I did kind of. I did kind of enjoy it, and then fortunately, it just became boring.
And that's what drew you back in, just boredom.
Yeah, I think that, and my sister who was living in London needed to find a tenant for the flat. So that's how I moved to Dalston and started making music again. And then I made a record called Anime and Bonomy in L.A., or New York and L.A., which I really enjoyed making. That was good fun.
What was different about that experience?
Partly the parameters that were set before I started, who did what was pretty clearly established. Mm-hmm. And I was just in a better state mentally, you know. I had a good therapist. He gave me some drugs that helped. And I was pretty chipper. And they were a great bunch of people I made the record with, and the sun shone, and it was just a happy time.
It didn't sell?
No.
At all. That didn't,
no.
Presumably this is no longer a concern, if it ever was a concern.
No, it didn't ever strike me as a concern. I'm not sure. I remember being in a room with Wendy Melvoin from Wendy and Lisa, and Michelle and DeGacello was playing the bass. And it was established pretty early on that this was going to be a record that only my mother would love, as it were. Do you know what I mean? And that was fine by me, because that's just what I wanted to do. But fortunately, within weeks of it coming out, Jeff Travis from Rough Trade got in touch and said, I think you've made a great record, but, you know, nothing's going to happen. You're in the wrong place with the wrong people, and would you let me help you?
You also started performing live again around that time, which is, it's a hell of a gap between live performance.
Well, yeah, the Panic Attacks had put paid to the last time I played live was with a Gang of Four on a tour in, I don't know, 79 maybe.
Well, the Panic Attacks, I mean, obviously you were living an unhealthy lifestyle at the time. Was part of the Panic Attacks down to the fact that you were going out and making improvised music on stage every night? Because it strikes me that if anything is going to cause a panic attack, this notion of not really knowing what's going to happen when you go on stage, whether it's going to be any good or not.
It really was just the discomfort of being the figure of attention that frightened me. And that escalated, you know, from being frightened half an hour before the gig to, if you had a tour to do or something, just a perpetual miserable... And speed was the drug of choice at the time.
Jesus, which is the worst possible thing.
Yeah. So it was just primed, really, all to go tits up. I was taken into hospital on that tour in Brighton, and they thought I'd had a heart attack. And so there was, and they detected some kind of heart arrhythmia that was probably just too much booze, speed, and anxiety. And but that was it. You know, I thought, well, I just can't do this anymore. So I stopped.
And was there any of that sense of trepidation still there when you decided to start performing live?
Yeah,
again?
Although Jeff said, why don't you, you know, play this windmill, a little pub in Brixton, and you could do it incognito. And if it's horrible, you need never do it again. Mm-hmm. And if it's not horrible, won't that be great? Mm-hmm. And the pleasure of doing it just about outweighed the discomfort.
What are you going to do next? I mean, you've done two new tracks for this.
Back at Rancho Gartside in Dalston, there is, a couple of hard drives full to bursting of unfinished songs for the album that should have come out on Rough Trade 2.5 years ago.
Right.
So I've just got to get my arse into gear and finish them. But there's just, you know, there's an awful lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think it's time to almost drag somebody in off the street and say, here's three songs, which of these should I finish?
Green Gartside from Skritti Politti there. Really interesting guy, I found. A sort of very odd attitude. Well, not necessarily an odd attitude to his past, but clearly not particularly enamoured of almost any aspect of his career at all, which seems an odd thing given that he's had very little other than sort of, you know, critical praise and, to a great or lesser degree, commercial success.
Yeah.
You've interviewed him as well, haven't you, Pete?
Yeah. I really liked him sort of straight away, and we spent a good sort of 3 hours in a pub near his house in sort of Dalston way. And I sort of got the impression that he was as sane as you can be, having done what he's done.
Mm.
I think sort of pop stardom is something that, obviously, no great insight here, but changes you irretrievably. And I thought the running away and seeking anonymity on a hill in Wales or wherever he ended up for a large amount of time was a perfectly sane and reasonable reaction to having to spend the day with someone who I think was dressed up as an elephant or so during during the course of radio promotion. Yeah, I think he said he never got to see what was underneath the false head.
But while still blasting hip hop out of that cottage, that's why.
That was his thing, wasn't it? It was the pub in the evening and hip hop all day.
But I find that interesting in some ways because it suggests that somebody wants to be noticed, to stand out in whichever tiny little corner of Wales he was in.
I guess so, yeah.
He reminds me, I've met him once, I haven't interviewed him, but I was on a panel with him.
Really?
Yes.
What was that about?
An intellectual panel. It was for a art festival in East London, and he was talking about, is there an East London music? You know, so it's all about, you know, which is a kind of fairly... Well, silly question in many ways.
Chaz and Dave, obviously.
Chaz and Dave. indeed. But
go home now.
Yeah.
Sorry, Lola.
Just sing Rabbit for 10 hours and then leave. No, but it was in Wilton's Music Hall and we were talking about the pop that's been built. I was really excited to meet him because I'd always liked his music. But he was, yes, a very strange person in the flesh, kind of not unfriendly at all, but kind of very, very guarded, as almost like he was behind a curtain.
Oh, right, it was.
Maybe it's because he was, you know, there to perform and pronounce, and he was very much against, as you would imagine, categorising music by place and categorising music in any way, shape or form. But he was... you know, he was very interesting and very you know, entertaining, but in a kind of in a way that struck me as very, very Welsh in a sense. In a sense
really,
there's a sense. Believe it or not, Welsh people are quite chippy. my other half would obviously not agree with that at all. But there's a kind of sense of having to prove yourself and your points and your intellect. And he did remind me a little bit of Nicky Wire in that sense,
yeah.
And that kind of approach to talking about music and justifying things and, you know, wearing his credentials on his sleeve. Not in any way that was aggressive or I know more than you,
no.
But almost trying to put his flag in the ground a little bit.
I think he started from a position of guilt, if you like, which a lot of, you know, sort of white middle-class musicians who really want to do something that's never been done before. And... So I think he was very, I think he had a kind of hair trigger kind of sensitivity to cliche within the pop song. So I think he felt at the very beginning that he had to make a brand new sound. I think this is a dilemma that Tom York has had, you know, over the last sort of 10, 15 years or so. I've cleverly noticed that. And so he felt like he needed to make a brand new. So I think that kind of explains the early sort of scritability. In which you also had lyrics which were sort of critiquing what was going on in the mainstream world. But you just get to a point where, you know, if you're fascinated by this stuff and you're critiquing it in song, then at some point I think you just want to make it. And the trade-off you do with yourself is, okay, the lyrics will still be really clever. And postmodern in some ways, and that way I feel like I'm furthering the discourse, which I think is what the transition we saw on Songs to Remember with songs like The Sweetest Girl, and then it carried on obviously when he had loads of money.
No, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because what he's clearly, there seems to be a dichotomy at the centre of what he does, in that what he's clearly interested in, as everybody really is interested in music, is that sort of moment of absolute transcendence and just music sort of sweeping you off your feet, you know, to the point where you don't really know what's going on. And the point is that you can't analyse that. You can't critique it. It's just something that happens. It's a moment, it's a complete moment of sort of otherness. So I think he's in this sort of weird thing where what he really loves about music isn't sort of deconstructing it via, you know what I mean, Gramsci or Derrida or whatever. It's just sort of the whoosh of like a really great disco record or something.
Yeah, but that's where the kind of blurring between a kind of journalism and music sort of happens in a way that's I think we all want to be near the thing, and some of us do that by just joining in the discourse, and others by actually kind of making the art, and both are enjoyable. That's why I sort of get a bit sort of weary of sort of certain people in bands who have this perception of criticism as being this thing that leeches off art. Because part of the fun of art is the discourse that surrounds it.
Definitely.
What else are we going to talk about? What we had for tea? Well, that's quite good too, obviously.
No, it's interesting, isn't it? You get there's not that many, you know, as you find out when you go to interview them, there's not that many band or artist that are that engaged with what's written about them beyond going like, oh, a bunch of arseholes.
I couldn't really think of somebody who was an equivalent of him. I was sort of trying to think who he was like in terms of talking about himself in that very intellectual sense. You know, the only person I can think of who does it to a certain degree, but in a very different way, is Lady Gaga, the president. Although, you know, she, the whole, it's not just about the music, it's about the discourse around it and also the imagery around it. And, you know, but...
Well, it's all, you know, it's all deliberate in that sense. You know,
it's talked about more than... by her.
I think it's more. The interesting thing is, if you listen to Lady Gaga talking about her music, you would think it was like Skritti Politti.
Exactly.
Because the way she describes it in these incredibly, you know, sort of highfalutin artistic terms, you would sort of think, wow, this is really, you know, whoa, these lyrics are going to be, you know, like that single she just come back with.
I find that really fascinating about her, you know, because people will say, well, you know, most people are just exposed to Lady Gaga by hearing it coming out of a car window. Mm. But we're not talking about Lady Gaga.
We're not talking about
Lady Gaga. But no, I know what you mean. You need to have substance.
I love that image of Green in his bedsit, and you know, the Public Image album has just come out, and but actually, what's being played on the radio is "It's a Love Thing" by Whispers, and Shalimar are just blowing up big, and this is what when you talk to him now, this is the music that he suddenly gets really excited about. And, you know, the DNA of which you can kind of hear in Skritti's early sort of virgin stuff, you know, Would Be's and Perfect Way and Absolute. And I think he's right. I think I would rather hear It's a Love Thing by Whispers than Death Disco.
Ooh, well, fair enough. Well, on that note, let's leave that there. Absolute, the Best Of by Skritti Politti is out now. Right, time for Singles Club, in which, as you doubtless know, we listen to a few new tracks, one from each of us. We're going to start with Jude's Choice. That's Licky Lee. Is it pronounced Licky Lee? Licky Lee. Sadness is a Blessing. Jude, that's your choice. Tell us why you brought it in.
I brought it in because I am way behind the curve and I'm catching up with various records that have come out in the last couple of months. And I've been really enjoying Licky Lee's new record. I love the fact that she sort of wants to be a pop star, but she also looks like the most austere, kind of fierce, slightly odd kind of woman in the world. Kind of, you know, she has this pop sensibilities, but she has this kind of austerity about her. I don't know, not austerity.
Sure, I know what you mean.
But this I brought in, particularly, this is an album track, Sadness is a Blessing, partly because this sound seems to be around quite a lot at the moment.
You cannot move for boom, 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 drums
exactly.
At the moment.
You know, Cat's Eyes, as Alexis, you and I talked about a couple of...
The vaccines?
A month or so ago, the vaccines, and... I'm just trying to get my finger on why this is going on at the moment. Licky Lee's voice as well, that's the thing that draws me to her and has always drawn me to her, even though there's lots of very interesting, you know, electronic burbles and beeps and goodness knows what about her music. She's got her voice, it has the same effect on me as, say, Bernard Sumner's voice did kind of in the early days of New Order. It's kind of off key, it's kind of a bit wonky, it's very naive.
Yeah.
But it. To me, it has that moment of transcendence for me. Because, you know, in that clip we heard now, you think, you know, even though she's missing the note by, you know, several miles, there's just something really lovely about it. And I'm just drawn to those voices. I don't know what it says about me.
Are you a fan of this, Pete?
Yeah, I love Licky Lee. And I was lucky enough to travel to Sweden and spend some time with her.
Oh.
Right, what's she like?
You come away just absolutely sort of enchanted by her, but in a kind of... But actually, also concerned about her.
Right? In what way?
Well, you know, the first album, Youth Movies, was really a document of this huge unrequited love she had with an unnamed Swedish musician, and it clearly had a huge effect on her. And he wouldn't commit to a relationship for whatever reason. So it kind of produced this huge, wonderful seam of music.
There's something about her like being really fragile while staring you in the eye and you think she's going to kill you. And I don't know how she managed to do those things simultaneously.
She's certainly
she
the most
does.
Sort of all those kind of Nordic pop female sort of singer-songwriter types about. She seems the weirdest and the most tricky and the most difficult to get, you know, to sort of pin down in a way. I haven't heard her new album, I'm afraid. Her first album I liked a great deal. But it was one of those records I came to thinking it was going to be a certain thing, and it wasn't when I started listening to it.
I was
a lot
obsessed
more
with that record, I have to say. And all the singles that came out from it, all the remixes, she handpicked really brilliant people.
There's a really great clip of her doing Dance, Dance, Dance with, is it Bon Iver?
They
sat around a fountain. Lovely. Outdoors and sort of Bon Iver is strumming away and she's singing.
The arrangements on those songs are brilliant. Like that song on the album where this kind of violin comes out of nowhere and there's just this kind of sound of like water dripping and not that much else really. And a little bit was just one of the greatest singles by anyone in the last few years.
Well, look, moving on. Licky Lee, Sadness is a Blessing. That is out now,
It's on the new album, which is called Wounded Rhymes.
Wounded Rhymes. And is that out now?
Yes.
Excellent. So, I really like that as well. Moving on, track two this week is from me. Okay, that's my choice. Cub by Solar Bears. That's the Keep Shelley in Athens mix. I confess to knowing nothing about Solar Bears. Certainly less about Keep Shelley in Athens. The Solar Bears album came out on Planet Mew and has been, widely praised in the blogosphere. I believe it seems to be somebody from Ireland. They're a duo. And it seems to be some kind of weird, almost ambient-ish kind of record. I mean, I don't know anything about it. I just heard this track on a blog. I really liked it. I really like the... it doesn't do what you expect it to do. When it starts out, it sounds very abstract and sort of scattered and like it's going to be that all the way through. And this sort of walloping kind of Balearic-y chorus thing comes in and then goes away again. It seems to be an intriguing take on... style of music.
It sounded fantastic. I'm curious. Do you demarcate special blog time where you go and make a point of listening to new things?
No. No. I was actually casting around for something to bring into Singles Club this week. I hadn't heard anything. Knew that it particularly tickled my fancy over the last 7 days. So I went and had a look on 20 Jazz Funk Greats, which is a great blog based in Brighton. Right. Very good for dance stuff.
With that record, the first thing I thought is ambient. Mm. And it seems that ambient isn't a kind of bad word anymore.
No. I was sort of quite intrigued. I haven't heard the Solar Bears thing. But that seemed to be the general gist of reading people writing about it. That seemed to be the general gist of what it was. Albeit produced in a kind of weird, who's that, like aerial pinkish kind of way.
Well, that's it. What's lovely about this is it's a kind of tasteful... reclamation of ambient, because there was a horrible period where, you would think of sort of, bronze twats at the Café Del Mar, tucking into their Sunday, their English breakfast.
The word chill out has disappeared, which is really nice.
That's a terrible phrase. I once went to the Café Del Mar, and this was the first time I went to Ibiza, and I was working for Mixmag. It was the height of the thing. Everybody, you've got to go and see them. Jose Padilla, he DJs the sunset at the Café Del Mar. It's amazing. Go down there at sunset, watch him DJ the sunset. It's so beautiful, it'll make you cry. Got down there. They were just playing the Café Del Mar CD, the compilation CD. It was very disappointing. The scales fell from my eyes.
They finally got to where they wanted to be.
They distilled the essence of what they wanted to do. And, anyway, look, I don't know when that record is coming out. I don't know anything about it.
I had a bit of a troll and I couldn't find a great deal apart from This Is Great.
This Is Great. You can certainly find it and download it off the 20 Jazz Funk Greats blog. Final music choice this week. Is Pete's.
Call the sunrise a street lamp. Let the moonlight prevail. Call the brazen lark a nightingale. Through the veil of deception, there is one stubborn truth. The one
that's Obard by The Gentle Good. Pete, that's your choice. Tell us about The Gentle Good. Tell us why I brought it in.
Well, The Gentle Good is essentially a chap called Gareth Bonello, who I think is about 30-odd. He lives in Cardiff. He was formerly a zoologist, specialising in birds. So So I don't, you know, probably not too much to talk to Pete Doherty about, should they?
Lots to talk to the guy from Elbow about, though. He's a preacher, isn't he?
And Edwin Collins.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. British Sea Power.
Is there a radio feature just, in there? Birds in
pop. Twitches in pop.
Anyway, he's a guitarist, and this is from his second album, Tethered to the Good. That song is 5 or 6 minutes long, and it just kind of fans gently out in this beautiful way. And, you know, anyone with a guitar gets compared to Nick Drake these days, and it can be a bit sort of off-putting. But there's something about the tuning that cut proceeds in, which is very reminiscent of particular Nick Drake's tracks. And then these wonderful string arrangements, which again very reminiscent of Robert Kirby. Mm-hmm. The whole album is beautiful. It's not all like that, but it's a very beautiful kind of pastoral baroque kind of playing. There are a couple of a cappella songs which I think feature Lisa Jen, who I think has worked with Griff Rees.
Yeah. Okay.
There you go.
It sounds great. I mean, I must admit, I am so bored of the putative influence of Nick Drake on artists that I tend to sort of not. If someone mentions Nick Drake in a press release, I tend to put it on the, you know, I'll listen to that when I've listened to all the stuff
absolutely,
I want to listen
yeah.
to. I really like that. I thought it was a really beautiful, beautiful song.
As much as anything, you could hear the people that had influenced Nick Drake. So there's a couple of tracks that really sound a lot like John Renbourn, that kind of slightly more baroque, kind of almost medieval style of playing.
Wow.
John Renbourn's back, isn't he?
He's got a new album out, which is very, very good. First album in 13 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
He's a very nice man.
And underrated. And kind of when everybody talks about kind of that kind of generation of 60s folk guitarists, people always talk about Bert Jansch, who is wonderful, obviously, and is better and well, which is fantastic because he hasn't been very well in the last couple of years. Mm. But John Renbourn gets a bit forgotten. I'm not sure why.
I think it's because John Renbourn is less of a brooding presence than Bert Jansch fits in exactly how you want a folk guitarist of that era to be. He's
and the album covers look amazing.
handsome and, you know.
Yeah, John Renbourn essentially has turned into Father Christmas.
Yes, he does look exactly like Santa, doesn't he? Yeah.
That label is quite interesting that Gentle Good is on, which is, I don't know how to pronounce it, sorry, ma'am, Guimon or Guimon or something like that, which I think Richard James is involved with from Gorky's Exotic Monkey, who makes records that are similarly, have got that lushness that a lot of acoustic guitar music says it has, but actually doesn't have.
Mm.
And it sounds like, well, they know each other, obviously. And kind
I think there's a kind of Cardiff sort of...
Cardiff scene.
Sort of folky scene, you know, and DVDs get exchanged, which have got, you know, grainy footage of Davy Graham. And, which makes me wonder why I'm not in Cardiff right now, actually. I heard through a third party that I inadvertently offended Richard James once.
I had...
For doing a podcast not dissimilar to this for another newspaper, which was The Times. I don't know what that is. I think everyone knows The Times actually exists. And anyway, we were talking about The Green Man, that he was due to appear at The Green Man that year when it was still in Crickhall. Mm-hmm. No, it still is in Crickhall. Yeah, sorry, I'm getting my... And he said Crickhall in such a lovely, lilting way. And I said, that's lovely. Could I just get to say Crickhall again? Mm-hmm. And I didn't pick up on how embarrassed he looked at the time. But anyway, he told a mutual friend of us later on that he thought it was quite offensive that I'd made him say Crickhall.
Really?
Yeah.
Aww. You were
sort of mocking
love.
His way. He thought you were mocking his sort of Welshness.
I was slightly mortified.
Prickly, chippy, as you said. Welsh people,
chippy,
generally.
Yes.
Chippy.
But, you know, who'd have thought that the bassist from Gorky's Exotic Monkey would go on to make two incredibly beautiful records?
No, not me.
Not that Gorky's Exotic Monkey have anything wrong with them, because they were the great lost British bands who would need to be proclaimed, and not just because of where they're from. I think their music is utterly beautiful.
Look, we're going to leave that there. We're nearly done. Just before we go, a few tweets and blog comments from the last few weeks. There are lots of messages left for us on the subject of protest songs, which we covered last week. Dave Portivo posted, "I think we may just be over-intellectualising this. I'm betting 90% of the reason we haven't heard more protest songs is because they simply sound crap. Seriously, I bet Coldplay have had a go at writing a balls-to-the-wall protest song, because let's face it, Chris clearly isn't worried about making a fool of himself just listening to Fix You, but it probably sounded awful, and they just decided to leave it on the cutting room floor." Interesting. I mean, that Agitator track sounded incredibly cringeworthy. Good bands tend to have a filter, whether it's a producer or a group veto, and I bet ham-fisted protest songs fall by the wayside. Interesting point. SV80 wrote an essay almost, which is worth reading, but thanks us for praising the works of Nina Simone and Machine on the programme, no problem for that. And I have no idea how you pronounce this, Pont-Sozanne or something like that, Pont-Sauxans, I've no idea. He wrote, or she wrote, it's in the genres affected by poverty and low job prospects, creating something to get out of the cycle forced upon them mainly by the rich white folks. So where can you find it? It's all there in grime, dubstep and hip-hop broadcast on the back of a bus out of tinny mobile phone speakers. You can leave your reviews and comments on anything else on the programme at the Music Weekly blog. That's guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. Anyway, that's it. We have come to the end. Thank you for joining us, Jude. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
To see you. Thanks to Pete. Thank you for coming. And come in again.
Oh, I'd love to, yeah.
It was great. It was really nice. Really nice having you. We're back next week. I'm Alexis Petridis, the producer of Scott Cawley, as ever. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.